Let's see the date. This way we'll know what the date is, and this way we'll...
Wait, hold on. Let me get out the papers.
Shalom.
We started last week studying Rav Kook's article called Chacham Adif Minavi. Just a very quick review of what we saw in the first paragraph. Kook talks about how there are basically two different types of chokhmah, of wisdom. And when you go for a interview for a vocational advice, so the first thing that they do is they ask you, are you more in the direction of the humanities or in the direction of the sciences? And were you all there? You weren't there. Oh, okay. Quick review is always good for everyone. In general, the difference between them is that the humanities are more descriptive. Right, like poetry, cartoonists, literature, what they do is they describe the situation. A satirist describes the situation in its beauty, right? That they describe it very, very picturesquely, and also when something is wrong, they know how to get you emotionally involved. The problem with the poet is that he doesn't deal with what caused the problems and what's going to solve the problems. Right? He doesn't analyze. He describes. Regarding the analysis, that's where the doctors and the engineers and the architects come in. That's where the sciences and the mathematicians, where they analyze what caused this woman to be beautiful, right? The poet will describe her beauty, but the analyst will describe where she bought her clothing, you know, where if she's not beautiful, what she should do to be beautiful. The same thing when it comes to something bad, right? The poet will describe that the beggar is, you know, begging with his tattered clothing, and he looks so sad, and tears spring down his hand. And you start to feel bad for him, you get emotionally involved. On the other hand, it's the analyst who's going to deal with what causes poverty and how we can solve the problem. Or in other words, the poet deals with the present, and the analyst deals with the past and the future. And if we take this up one step historically, that's where we got up to. I just gave you a little foreshadowing at the end of the shiur last week. Lemala mize, or at the beginning of the second paragraph, if we take this a little up in history, a little previously, hanivua ra'ata et zerem ha-kalkala gdola shel avuda zara. The prophets are like the poets. They saw the stream of it and the rot that Avodah Zarah, that paganism brought to society. If you remember, we spoke once about how paganism wasn't just a philosophical problem or a mathematical problem. Is there one god or 10 gods or 100 gods? But it's a moral problem. Right? The paganist gods are always taking from each other. They're always fighting with each other. And in paganist culture, the imitatio dei, right, the imitating of your god is to imitate an immoral god. And that's why in paganism, inevitably the people are going to be immoral. And it's not even on their agenda. On the other hand,
what's not on their agenda?
Morality. It's considered a weakness. Like Nietzsche said that morality is for Jews, it's for women, it's for wimps, it's for people who can't really compete and fight it out, you know, in the dog-eat-dog world.
Nietzsche wasn't a moral person.
Sorry?
Nietzsche wasn't a moral person.
No, he was anti-morality. He said morality, it was a Jewish invention.
It is. From the Torah. It is a Jewish invention.
You're right? He wasn't stupid, but he was evil. And by the way, Hitler, Yamach Shemo, based a lot of his Mein Kampf theories on Nietzsche. Right? He wasn't a philosopher, but Nietzsche was. And according to the idea of the survival of the fittest, the question is, how the heck did Jews survive? Right? We're not the strongest. We're not the most beautiful. So why? How are Jews always surviving at all?
We're smarter than everyone else.
Oh, so Nietzsche doesn't use the term, the positive term, because that would be a compliment. He says the Jew is the trickiest of them all. He's not the smartest, but the trickiest. He invented this concept whenever the bully came around to defeat the Jews. I read that's what history is made up of, right? You got the Egyptians were the superpower, and then the Assyrians were the superpower, and then the Greeks were the superpower, and the Romans were the superpower, and everyone, always that survival of the fittest, until the Germans. Now, you don't have Babylonians or Philistines or Ammonim or even Greeks or Romans anymore. So why in the world do Jews still survive? So Nietzsche explained that the Jew invented this idea called morality, the conscience, where if a bully would come to eradicate the Jewish people, the Jew would say, "Don't you have a conscience? Don't you have a heart? Don't you feel bad about what you're doing?" And Nietzsche said the conscience is a Jewish invention. They asked him, what about women? You know, women are nice, and they are merciful, and they're nurture, and they have a conscience. And Nietzsche did not like women either. He said they're wimps, and Jews are like a feminine people. And they, just like women, trick men into getting what they want.
That makes no sense.
Not by competing. I'm just saying what he says.
This makes absolutely no sense when you're killing. So when you look at the, let's say the, what are they called? The people from Norway.
Yeah.
They just, you know,
Vikings.
They just wipe everybody
out. I also never understood where exactly, now what ma'amad and what framework, according to Nietzsche, did the Jews really sit down and tell the goyim what you don't have a conscience?
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't. But okay. Anyway. Why don't we mention Nietzsche? Because that's what paganism is about. It's about being immoral, and that's why they sacrificed their children, and they had orgies, and everything is very here and now and physical-oriented. And if you're really from in paganism, you sacrifice your oldest son, right? Which is, we see, as the most irreligious thing to do. For them, it was the most religious thing to do, because the gods do it all the time. They're killing and taking, etc. In a monotheistic religion, where there is only one God, and he doesn't fight with anybody, and he's perfect, so he doesn't take anything, so what does he do all day? He gives. He's a giver. And if you remember, hopefully this sounds familiar, that's what we spoke about, the Ramchal brings it down from the Zohar, that our imitatio Dei, our copying of our God, is to be as moral, as giving, as altruistic as you can.
But that's not what people say. People say that God is all the time demanding. He's demanding you put on film. He's demanding you do this. He's demanding you do that. These are, that's why they're called commandments, because God doesn't agree.
We spoke about that, if you remember. We had a whole shiur, I don't know if you were there, where Rav Kook explains that obviously a perfect God, when he gives us mitzvot, they are not for his sake, because he doesn't need anything. They're for our sake, for our benefit. Okay. And like a father, always remember the mashal of the father and the son. Right? The loving father, loving parent, a lot of times he will suggest to his son to do something or not to do something. Sometimes he'll even intervene if it's something really important, you know. No, you cannot just stay home and waste your life. You have to go to school. You can't, you know, sometimes parents will say, yes, there is an obligation. Yeah. Nevertheless, Navi Yeshayahu calls the mitzvot etzot mirachuk. And the Zohar uses this term, etzata. They're etzot. They are good ideas.
Those are for the cardiac Jews.
Sorry?
Those are for the cardiac Jews.
No, but it's for all. It's for all. We all believe that the mitzvot are good for our heart, they're good for our personality. And the bottom line is we have to do them whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not, whether you understand it or not. That's true. Nevertheless, that the approach, the adult approach to mitzvot, and I think we had a whole show on this, is that especially in our generation, you have to observe the mitzvot out of identification. And that you really believe in them, you really want them, you believe that they're beneficial, rather than just because Mr. God told you so. Because that doesn't go well in our generation. And this is, of course, our generation is very misugal, is very capable of serving Hashem and even returning to Hashem, people who are far away, out of ahava, out of love, out of identification with the loving Father, and not out of yira. Okay? Getting back to the Avodah Zarah and the Nevi'im, so the prophets were describing, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, how immoral paganism is, and how they're mistreating the widows, and they're mistreating the orphans, and they're taking advantage of and exploiting the weak and the poor, and how bad paganism is. Did it work? I don't know.
What did work?
The prophets. They did not succeed.
The prophets succeed. Are not the paganism work. For them.
Right. The prophets did not succeed in uprooting Avodah Zarah or Gilur Arayot and Shlichut Damim. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to shift gears to find a different approach. Okay? I imagine all of you understood that Rav Kook is saying that the Nevi'im, the prophets of yesterday, they are like the poets, right, who write with righteous indignation, and they describe the beauty of the Geula and the evil of paganism and immorality, but it did not work. And a lot of times people think today, if we would just have some prophets, you know, everyone would be Bali Tshuva. And the answer is mamash no. People, they assassinated Yeshayahu, he was killed. They tried to kill Yirmiyahu. Ahab tried to kill Eliyahu. The prophets were not popular because they were telling the people exactly that, which the people did not want to hear.
Here.
And
people don't like to be told what to do.
Nachon.
And they don't like to be told they're not
the savior. But that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to, now we're going to shift gears to the analysis. Okay, so what's going to solve the problem? Prophets didn't work. 613 mitzvot didn't work. We had a heck of a lot of mitzvot, but it was not enough. And it wasn't working. So the Nevi'im, they ranted about the evils of paganism, umachta negdo b'cholos, with all their strength, with all their emotion. And they also describe the beauty of monotheism and morality. Again, that's the job of the prophets, the lahavdil, the poets. They spoke about how terrible things are and how God is going to punish us and we got to catch ourselves and do tshuva. Ritzutz dalmi, Moshe kevyonim. That people are crushing the poor, are exploiting the misfortunate. Retzach, v'ni'uf, murder, adultery. Again, these are the three cardinal sins where the Gemara Masechet Yoma, Daf Tet Amud Bet, tells us that the first Beit HaMikdash was destroyed because of the three cardinal sins. Chamas, v'shod, they didn't just choose these three and they observed everything else. It's even the big three they didn't do. And they stole. And they robbed. And they spoke in very high, lofty, emotional words, but it did not work. So what's the solution? Next paragraph, third paragraph. We're on page 121, Kuf Chaf Aleph in Rav Kook's Orot. Hasearot hadakot. The thin hairs, shemehen mitzarfot avot ha'agala shel ha'chatat. Gidei ha'chayim, the veins, the thin veins, shemehen yisorgu mizrakei adam ha'gdolim, that bring the blood of life to the far out appendages.
Talk about poetical.
Ela, that's an interesting point. Rav Kook is very poetic and very rational. And he is like the epitome of both, and as we're going to see in the end, that's really the answer. The two don't contradict, and they're meant to harmonize together. But we'll get there. Ela hema mistorim atzfunim me'ein shem naviv chuzeh. The prophets deal with the klal, with the general picture, and they don't deal with the details. And by the way, and we mentioned this last week, that's why Gretz, we mentioned the historian Gretz last week, and the Maskilim, the Enlightened, yeah, and David Ben-Gurion loved the Nevi'im. He said that Judaism should be like Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel, because they talk about nice ideals, they talk about being moral and helping people, and not exploiting, and socialist, and all these ideas. Nice ideas, and they don't bother us. I guess in the tape you can't see bother.
In quotation
marks. They don't bother us with Shabbat and Kashrut and all those details that, you know, that make Judaism difficult. And that, by the way, the average Israeli today, he believes in Torah, the God, there is a God, and we are the chosen people, and that he gave Torah to Sinai, but they don't like the rabbinic laws, which, as we said last week, that's most of Judaism. Right, from Netilat Yadayim in the morning, that's Midrabanan. Mode Ani, Berchot HaShachar, most of Davening, your Brachot, many of the laws of Tzniut, many of the laws of Shabbat, many laws of Lashon Hara, many laws, or just if you check it out, most of Judaism is details which the rabbis added on. And that was the question that we spoke about last week. Do we really need all of this baggage, all of these details? And Rav Kook here is beginning the answer. He's saying that life is like hair. Hair in Kabbalah is called Tiferet. Tiferet is where you take an individual. What is hair like? I have two younger sisters. And,
say no about you.
I always used to get angry at them when I found these little hairs in the sink in the morning when I came to brush my teeth. Right? And because little hairs, individual hair, is something very disgusting. On the other hand, when you have a lot of hair and it's harmonized and it's organized and it's shampooed and it's
lice free,
right? Then that is what's called tiferet. And that's why the Zohar explains why the hair of married woman is considered something that needs to be covered. Because hair is something extremely beautiful when it comes as a group. But when you see an individual hair, it is not very appealing. Like I said, look in your comb, look in your brush, look in your sink. And that is the, what's called tiferet. Have you heard the term tiferet in the Kabbalah? I'm sure in the Chabad you've heard it. You don't have a Chabad background?
We do not.
Ah, okay. Whatever. The mitzvot are, you could also see where Rav Kook is going. Life is made up of details. Evil people are not born that way. Nobody is born a bank robber. But what happened is if their parents don't educate them and give them red lines and tell them what to do and what not to do when they're kids, then when they get to Gan, they have difficulty with the discipline. And how much more so if their ganenet doesn't discipline them. And nobody likes to play the heavy, especially today. And I know this in Midrashot, you know, nobody likes disciplining. They always pass the buck, you know. The principal wants to be the nice guy and says, oh, you teachers should be disciplining. The teachers want to be their friends. So they say, no, the principal should be disciplining. And nobody likes to discipline. And most families also. The father wants the mother to discipline. The mother wants the father to discipline. And nobody wants to discipline. And in the end, it's one problem which isn't dealt with, and then another problem isn't dealt with, and that's where bank robbers come from. That's where violent husbands come from. That's where they weren't born that way. But it's another hair and another hair and another hair, and that makes the rope into what the Rav Kook is alluding to, is Gemara Masechet Sukkah Daf Nun Bet, which says that sin is like a rope. It starts out with a cobweb. You allow yourself to slip on one thing, and you can correct yourself very easily. A cobweb, you know, you just cut it, you break it, you don't need a scissor, just break it. But if you repeat it a second time, and then a third time, and then a fourth time, eventually it becomes habit. You say, no lightning struck me down, you know, I guess it's okay, you know, and the world didn't fall apart, you know, if I, you know, I don't know, was a little lenient regarding this thing or that thing, and, you know, I think, should I say it, maybe it's Lashon Hara, maybe, I'll say it. And you get a lot of laughs, and you do it again, and you do it again, and that is where that's what problems are. And the same thing, conversely, with good people. Good people are made up of good actions. And now we're not talking about one big action. You know, we're not talking about, yeah, I have to find a vaccine for cancer. You don't have to win a Nobel Prize. But as my grandmother, Aliyah Shalom, told me when she heard that I was going out, she said, don't make the mistake that everybody makes. Everybody goes for the most beautiful, or the most this, or the most talented, or the most funny, or the most this, or the most that. Go for a girl who is nice, who is considerate, who does the small things, and brings greatness. Rav Kook has a nice phrase, Ein koten begodel. Ein koten begodel. There is nothing small for a great person. One of the things I used to do in my midrashah, in between classes, I used to stand in the coffee corner and notice how the girls would make their son's cup of coffee. And you could tell a lot about a person in the coffee corner. And I talked about the small things. Inevitably, there are some girls, you know, who on the way from the jar to the cup, some coffee spills. And you see that there's some girls that take a sponge and clean it up. And there are other girls that don't even notice, or don't care, or pretend that they don't notice. And then sometimes it's, you know, from the urn, you know, to the seat. You know, they spill a little, put in a little too much milk. And you'll see some girls, it wasn't even them who spilled the coffee, but they will take a paper towel and bend down and clean up somebody else's coffee. Right? That is a small action. But when I would see a person, you know, who does those small actions, I would point it out to the others as something, you know, hey, this is something that everyone should do. You know, isn't that nice? Isn't it commendable? Isn't it something that I should do? And on the other hand, if I would see a girl who really, in the small things, who would be the spiller, and wouldn't clean it up, I wouldn't talk to her specifically about that. But this girl needs more work on her midot. And basically that's what Rav Kook is saying, is life, for good or for bad, is made up of another action and another action and another action. And it starts out as a cobweb, but eventually that single hair turns into a rope and tiferet and makes you either a fantastic person or a terrible person. But it all gets down to details. And this is where the Chachamim, Chazal, in the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, they switch from the gear of the Navi to the Chacham.
Can I ask a question?
Right, now just so this is, remember last week we mentioned, it's a quote from Baba Batra on Daf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, where Chazal tells Chacham Adif Mi Navi, that the wise person is greater than the prophet, which is a surprising, I would think, that the opposite, a prophet is greater than a rabbi. Chazal are telling us that where the prophets failed to uprut avodah zarah, shfichut damim, and gilui arayot, the rabbis during the second Beit HaMikdash, because they added another mitzvah, and another fence, and another mitzvah, and another mitzvah, and in the next sentence, we'll discuss how it works. But basically, it's the idea of tiferet, of getting us preoccupied with good, small actions. Yeah?
You said that it either leads to a good person or an evil person, but is there not something in the middle?
Yeah. Some people who do a little good actions, and they have good details, or they have some bad details, and some this, some that, yeah. But the idea is, the point is, when that says the point isn't that that people are all black or all white, obviously. The idea is that you are your actions, your small actions. If you want to be good, you got to focus on all your small actions. How you talk, how you walk, how you dress, how you eat, and that's what Chazal did. The Torah shot the arrow. The Torah is like a vector, right? That's what they call it in math. Where it showed us the direction. You know, the Torah gives us a lot of do's and don'ts, but it wasn't enough. And Chazal built a fence around the Torah and added more laws on what to eat and what not to eat, and what to speak and what not to speak, and what to wear and what not to wear, and they did the job. Okay? HaMitzvot HaMa'asiyot Kulan UPirtei Hilchoteihen. The practical details and all of the si'ifim and sub-si'ifim, right? Paragraphs and sentences and chapters. V'chol diyukam hanimratz, with all of their exactness. Ich be'emshech hazman al yidei kiyumam v'talmudam hergilam v'chibatam yetze ha'noam apnimi ha'chavui bahem. The goodness comes out of being preoccupied with details of goodness. What's an example? The classic example, I saw this from personal experience. My father, Areni Kaparat Mishkavo, for more than almost 30 years, ran an ulpan for giyur, for converts. And as you all know, you don't have to, and you can't, teach the convert all of the mitzvot. What do? You teach them, give them a taste of Shabbat, a taste of Kashrut, a taste of this, a taste of that, so that they have a general overview, so that then when they do accept the Torah mitzvot, so they know what they're talking about. I once spoke with a group of converts about the laws of Lashon Hara. So I started out by saying, is it nice to slander? She said, no, obviously. And I mentioned it's in the Torah that lo telech rachil ba'amech, you're not allowed to gossip. And then I asked them, what is the definition of slander? And they basically said to put somebody down. What does it mean to put somebody down? On the other hand, aren't there situations where you have to say something negative about a person in order to protect others? Right, in order to protect society, in order to protect their wife or their children, or right? Sometimes it's a mitzvah, it's an obligation. So they started getting like a puzzled look, you know, hey, I never thought of that. And then I went through just about 15, 20 examples from the Chafetz Chaim, and after the second or third example, it just floored them. They could not believe how the rabbis got into such detail about what can you say, and what can't you say, and what are you obligated to say, and what you're not allowed to say, and what if it's for a shidduch, and what if it's not for a shidduch, and what if it's in a newspaper, and what if it's not in a newspaper, and what if it's something religious, what if it's, what about, it was a classic, they couldn't believe that you're not allowed to say something good about somebody in a group, that somebody is going to say something bad. Now, if you don't have a reason to think that somebody is going to slander, so you know, by all means, say something good. But if you know that there's somebody who's competing with them or something like that, or somebody negative, we all know that certain people are extremely negative, if there's a negative person in the group, then in that situation, you're not even allowed to say something positive because inevitably somebody is going to say something negative. They could not believe how moral a standard speech could be. Now, everybody knows that Lashon Hara is difficult. And the only solution that I've ever seen is to go every day on a regular basis and learn a chapter, a paragraph even, from the Chafetz Chaim Shmirat HaLashon. Because what does he do? He brings up situation after situation after situation after situation, and it's all details. It's 300 pages of details. But it preoccupies you. It brings it on your agenda. You start noticing it, hey, when somebody else speaks it. You start noticing it when you're about to speak it. You start noticing when your children. You start, it changes your speaking agenda. I'll give you another example. A couple years ago, I saw in the Mishnah Berurah that there's a minhag to give tzedakah. You all know they're supposed to give 10% of your income to tzedakah. Here also, by the way, there are a lot of details. What if you're just barely finishing the month? What is 10%? Is it brutto? Is it netto? Before tax? After tax? What about taxes in the Jewish state? Is that considered? Can you take on Maser Kesafim? What if it's a tzedakah? What if it's to goyim? What if it's not? There are so, you could spend literally probably a year or two full time learning the laws of how much tzedakah you're supposed to give. Now, one of the minhagim is not just the percentage, but that it's good to, that action of giving is something very positive. I think it's the Shlap who says you should try and give 3 coins of tzedakah a day. 3 coins a day. And it's the idea of, again, not just writing a check once a year before Yom Kippur, but every day to give, and then to give, and then to give.
And you just, don't tell it to the schnorrers. Otherwise, they'll knock on the door every day.
You'll give them a check.
So what I started doing, just technically, if you think about it, it sounds like a nice wing hug, right? You can see the logic in it. You could see the benefit in it, you know, that action of giving and giving and making that habit. But something that I didn't think of at first glance is that in order to have, to always have coins in your pocket, you have to think ahead. And since then, every time I buy a falafel, I ask for change, you know. I can't give tens, you know, 3 tens every day. So I asked to give me the change, not the schneckles, the 2, not the 5, and the 10, to break it down into individuals so that I always have coins. And I noticed something, that minhag brings what the Shla succeeded in doing is not just those 3 times, 3 actions a day, but every time I buy falafel, every time I buy chewing gum, every time I have tzedakah on my mind. Do you all see how this works? It
changes your focus.
It changes your focus, and it changes your habits, and it changes your agenda on daily and daily and daily and daily. How to bring altruism into your falafel, right? Into your, you know, chewing gum, right? And it's an unbelievable idea. I'll give you another example. Reb Moshe Feinstein in his yeshiva, MTJ, Masifta Tiferes Yerushalayim, on the Lower East Side. One year, the Rebbeim said that the kids cannot connect with oxes goring cows, or Eila Metziot, or Hamafkid, or all these, you know, monetary mesechtot. So they decided that they're going to learn with the mesecht brachot. Like Kriyat Shema, Tefillah, it's all halacha l'maaseh, right? Oh, the kids will enjoy it better. And they didn't tell Reb Moshe, but Reb Moshe found out about it, and he called a meeting of the staff, and he said, there are 3 problems here. Number one, you don't change a tradition without first asking. You know, that's what I'm here for, and that's what Rosh Hashiva is there for. And the tradition was not invented by Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, right? There very often, usually, is logic by tradition. Why do we start kids out in elementary school with Hamafkid, with Eila Metziot? That's number one. Number two, Masechet Brachot, you know, it sounds very nice and appealing, and halacha l'maaseh, and a lot more interesting, you know, Kriyat Shema and Davening, a lot more interesting, as if it were, than these monetary mesechtot, right? A Baba Kama, Baba Mutzia. Reb Moshe said, what's going to happen when the kid comes home on Shabbat and he sees that the young Israel of who knows where, they're davening at 9 o'clock in the morning. And Sozman Kriyat Shema was at 8:30. what message is the child getting? You know, either, you know, my father's not really serious, or my shul isn't serious, or my rabbi isn't serious, or this
gemara
isn't serious. You know, outdated. It's not outdated, you know, it's not, nobody does it anymore. So he's not going to do anything. He's just going to chuck it all. That's problem number two. Problem number three, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, what is the advantage, and why in the yeshiva world do they start out kids with the monetary laws and gemara? He said that if a child in fourth or fifth grade, sach hakol, how much is it going to cover in a year? They go very slow. You know, until they understand, until everyone understands, and you review, and maybe an entire year they'll cover three pages of Gemara. But, said Rav Moshe, over an entire year of learning Eilu Metziyot, you know, that how much... When are you allowed, if you find a lost object, when are you allowed to take it? When do you have to leave it? When do you have to announce it? If you find a shtar, a 20 shekel note, are you allowed to take it? Is that a siman? What if you found two 20 shekel notes piled on top of each other? Maybe somebody left it there on purpose, right? What if there is a rubber band around them? Maybe that's a siman, and then you have to return it. What if it's in a wallet? Now, a lot of people have the same wallet, so maybe that's not a siman. On the other hand, maybe it is a siman. You spend an entire year, and you probably say several thousand times, what's not yours, you don't take. And Rav Moshe said, halavai, that every Jewish child, after 12 years of Jewish education, should know at least that one sentence. It's not yours, you do not take. And that is the wisdom of that Shas, and of the Shulchan Aruch, and of the Torah, and of the Rambam. And the mitzvot, and this the details of how to be a better person, like we saw in Ephraim Kishon, right? For whatever reason, even the non-religious has to admit that the kosher kitchen produces better people, better children, and statistically, religious people volunteer more, give more tzedakah, and anything that you can measure, religion, not just Jewish, also Christian, any monotheistic religion which has morality on its agenda is going to be that much more helpful. Why? Because, again, you look at the Christians. The Christians, you have to give charity. Yeah, they're in favor of charity. How much? You know, they pass
guidelines.
Around the plate. They pass around the plate. I remember that on TV. The churches, they seem passing around the plate. And I don't know how much they give. They don't talk in percentages. They don't talk in halacha.
They
don't talk about guidelines.
It's
they don't.
All open.
Yeah. You know, is it good to be a
sanua? They actually take from the Judaism, they say tithe.
Yeah.
They do use the word tithe in Christianity.
Like the more they use, the better. But the problem is that one of the Chidushim of Christianity, without getting into whether it was a Yeshu or was it Peter or Paul or who made the change, was that they threw out the details of the mitzvot. And that's exactly what Rav Kook goes on to say. Chazal liken Christianity to a chazir. Why to a chazir? Because the chazir, the pig, shows externally, I'm kosher. Right? He has split hooves. But internally, he doesn't chew his cud. And that's Christianity. Christianity says, hey, you should be moral, you should do charity, don't slander, be a nice person. Like, that's the klalim, the general ideas that Ben Gurion and Gretzen, the reform, everybody likes those general ideas. But if you don't have details, if you don't have tiferet, if you don't have the guidelines, what is the definition? And you look sometimes even the Southern Baptists, you know, are really Bible belters, and they're really religious, and they talk about having a good family life and being modest and dressing modestly. Which is sometimes, you know, in my writing, you know, compare Judaism with the Christianity, you go into their websites, and, you know, today everything is visuals. They have pictures of women who no halachic Jew would put that on a website. You know, because if you don't want cap sleeves, or short sleeves, or long sleeves, or house sleeves. They don't go into details, you know. And I'm sure they use modestly dressed women compared to, you know, what's going on in the street. Nevertheless, if you don't have a Shulchan Aruch, if you don't have that eternal constant, then you're going to be jumping up and around and being influenced by society, being influenced by fans, and you won't be who you want to be.
I just saw a woman who posted on Facebook that she doesn't want to wear, a Christian woman, who wrote on Facebook that she doesn't want to wear leggings because she doesn't think it's mana, she thinks it's... Uh-huh. And this way, she said to herself that anytime she leaves the house, she won't wear the leggings, she'll wear a skirt, a long skirt on top of it.
Yeah.
People were giving her a flack, and people were saying, how could you possibly do that? What's going on here? People were, because this was a Christian woman, in her mind, she realized it wasn't modest. Mm-hmm. But nobody said anything to her, and this was her personal decision, and yeah. Everybody's saying, well, I don't know, what's your problem? Like,
and
why?
Everyone has their own,
right.
Makes their own decision.
Right.
Now, Rav Yuval Sherlo once gave a beautiful explanation on the last pasuk in Megillat Rut. Not the last pasuk, towards the end of Megillat Rut, if you remember, it says that the women blessed Rut when she was marrying Boaz, that she should be Kirachel Uchelea, Asher Banu Yachdav et Beit Yisrael, who together they built the house of Israel. Why do you need Rachel and Leah? Why is the ideal Jewish woman also Rachel and also Leah? So we'll start with the Zohar. And this is a mashal that I think we gave once. The Zohar says that a person who loves the king wants to hug him in his clothes, obviously. Some people go overboard and they go into the king's closet and they'll kiss the clothes without the king. Other people on the other extreme will, you'll excuse me, go into the shower where the king is without his clothes, and they'll go and hug him without his clothes, which is chutzpah. And the only way to hug a king is in his clothes. The clothing is the mitzvot. And that is how we can see the king, and that is how we can hug the king. Now, some people make the mistake, and instead of serving God, they serve the Shulchan Aruch. And they go overboard on these details, and they turn the forest into millions of individual trees. And that is those who go into the closet and kiss the clothing without the king. You all with me? To kiss the clothing without the king is somebody who serves, whose Judaism is just. Do you have to cover till here or to here or to here? What is Sazvan Kriyat Shema? What is Sazvan Fila? What kind of kashrut is this? What kind of this? And it gets a person, it's the letter of the law, and somebody who just gets fixated, and there's the mistake of Ben Gurion and Gretz, somebody who just looks at the detail without the general idea, somebody who just learns halacha and just learns Baba Metzia without learning Kuzari, without learning Rambam, without learning philosophy, without learning Musar, he is going to be serving the Shulchan Aruch rather than God. Do you all see? He is kissing the king without his clothes. On the other hand, in every generation, today they call them Reform, sometimes they're called Enlightened, sometimes in every generation there's a group of Jews, Christians, right, who think that they can kiss the king without his clothes, right? That they can serve God. We don't need all these mitzvot. We don't need all these details. I can be a nice guy, and, you know, I don't need these guidelines. And the Zohar says both he and he are both terribly mistaken. You have to kiss the king in his clothes. This duality is Rachel and Leah. Rachel has a very interesting, this is, by the way, we're obviously talking about not just relationship between a man and his wife, but our relationship with God, which in Shir HaShirim is likened with two lovers. Yaakov's relationship with Rachel was hot. And he was infatuated with Rachel. And he loved Rachel. And he was very disappointed when he got Leah. And they have a very strong relationship, but they're the first couple that we see in the Torah that fight. You know, and she says, you know, Havali bani avim, I meta anochi, you know, give me children. And he argues back, well, I can give you children, go complain to God. And they have a lot of ups and downs, but it is very emotional. It's very poetic. It's very Navi. Right? On the other hand, Leah has a relationship with Yaakov, which a lot of people can't figure out. And anybody who works with young women, see, they have the same problem with the ketuvah. Why do we have the wedding? You know, it's so nice. It's so romantic. You know, it's usually done at sunset. And it's so, you know, there's so many nice parts of the wedding. And why in the middle of the wedding do you start reading the ketuvah? You know, I'm going to give you A, B, C, and D. You know, and it's, you all know what I'm talking about. And it really isn't very romantic. Just like when Leah comes to Yaakov and says, hey, I bought you for the dudaim of my son. You are to sleep with me in my tent tonight. Remember that? And we're trying to figure out what's going on. Why is that written in the Torah? But the idea is that every relationship, every loving relationship needs a Rachel and a Leah. And just like our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I give an example of two of the greatest tefillot that I ever had. One of them, when I was in Tzfat for Shabbat, about 20 years ago, it was the first time I ever went. That was when they first started the Karl Bach Minyan there. It started there in Tzfat, the Beirav Shul. And I don't know what the women feel behind the mechitza, and especially the 80% who are left outside, I don't know what kind of experience they got. But I was inside, and it blew me away. And I remembered in the middle of the dancing, that Kabbalat Shabbat, I said to myself, this is what davening is supposed to be. And it was just so emotional, and I just was so carried away, something that I'll never forget. That's Rachel. That's a Rachel davening. On the other hand, one of the other greatest tefillot that I had was, I was in Miluim, it was during the winter, and it was raining, and we had intelligence reports that terrorists were going to come and throw Molotov cocktails, so we had to lie in ambush for 4 hours. It was like from 10 to 2, and it was raining, and it was freezing, and we didn't have proper winter gear. And we were in the mud. And has anybody ever had to sit in mud for 4 hours in freezing rain?
No.
You know, you really have to appreciate what Chayalim do for you.
I'll send my son the mud for sharing.
And I came back. We came back at like 2 a.m. And I remembered that I had to do Shmirah at 5 a.m. So I just took off my army boots. I said, I don't sleep in my wet uniform. I just got into my bed, in my tent. It was freezing. We didn't have heat. We didn't have hot water. We didn't have... And I just... And there's something I don't know if women know about, but before you go to sleep, you also say Kriyat Shema Lamita. And as soon as I got to Shema Yisrael, I said to myself, darn it, I didn't daven Mari. Now, next thing I realized, I had to go to the bathroom, right? Not allowed to daven if you have to go to the bathroom. Bathroom's on the other side of the camp. And I have to get my army boots back on, go out into the freezing rain, and go to the bathroom, and wash my hands in the freezing cold water. And I just keep saying to myself, darn it. And I step in a puddle, darn it. And I was just so angry. And nothing, you know, just nothing was going right. And I couldn't find my siddur, and I said, oh, I'll daven just by heart. And I just started davening, and I really was not davening with a lot of kavanah. And I said, oh, I had to wake up, and it was already, 2 hours and 45 minutes. And I was, you know, when you're wet, it's hard to fall asleep. And I was telling myself, I'm not going to be able to sleep. And oh, b'chal, you know, maybe I shouldn't have joined the army. I could be back in Riverdale, New York.
In your warm bed.
In my warm bed. With central heating. Or, you know, I have a medical problem. I could have gotten out of the army. I raised my profile so they would accept me into a Yechida Kravit, and I didn't even have to be here. And I was, you know, sometimes you get very angry. And there in the middle of Shmona Asrei, as these thoughts were running through my mind, I was saying the words, it just hit me. I would not be doing this for too many people. To daven in the freezing cold, netilat yadayim, and going to the bathroom and davening, and I just thought to myself, hey, I'm pretty loyal.
Pat on the back.
Yeah. And you know, God, you can depend on me. And it turned into one of the most spiritual, uplifting tefillot that I ever had. And that is what we do in the ketuvah. In the ketuvah, what we do is we don't want just a Rachel relationship, because there has to be a Leah relationship. That I am obligating Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. You can depend on me. And by the way, that is the Kabbalistic explanation why, it's interesting, in all the Idot, Ashkenaz and Sephardim, we do Kiddushin with a ring. Right? You can give a pruta, you can give a piece of beastly, you can really give it. Why do we all use a ring? And why does the woman go around the Chatan 7 times? So in Kabbalah they explain that a ring or a circle symbolizes the letter Samech, which is from the Hebrew word lismuch. You can rely on me. When a man gives the samech, puts on his wife's finger, he is saying, you can depend on me no matter what. And you know what? Chas v'shalom, I'm sure we all know his stories, that one of the spouses is in a car accident and is paralyzed from the neck down, and turns out that he or she is not the husband or wife that I thought that I was getting. Am I going to abandon him? And the answer is, not if you're loyal. Not if you're dependable. And that's what love is about. That even when it's raining, and even when it's cold, and even when you really don't want to get out of bed to pick up the child, I am going to do it because you can depend on me. Because I really wouldn't do this for other people. But for you, I'll do it. Or for my children, I'll do it. And this is what a woman is saying to her chatan when she goes around him 7 times. You can depend on me. I will be your samech. You can sumech. You can rely on me. You know, that exercise that the marriage counselors do, you know, they have one stand in front of the other and just fall back and show, do you really rely on your husband or on your wife? Can you really trust them? Can you? And that's the one our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is supposed to be about. Not just Rachel, not just the Karl Bach Minyanim with all the emotion and the Klalim, and that's Yeshayahu, that's the poet, that's the Navi. But also Leah. You can depend on me, and I will be a good Jew. And you know what? Just a little take that to story. It also ran through my mind that I wouldn't lie in ambush for 4 hours for too many people. In the rain, in the cold, in the mud. And then sleep in my cold army boots. And then wake up 3 hours later and do another Shmirah. And apparently I really love Am Yisrael. And apparently I really love Eretz Yisrael. And no, I would not want to live in Riverdale and not with a nice house with a white picket fence and not with the heating, the central heating, and because I chose to make Aliyah and I chose to go to Tzahal, and that is part of loyalty to Am Yisrael and dependability. And that makes us good people. It's the details. Right? You don't have to win a Nobel Prize. You don't have to be the Prime Minister. But if you're willing to go to the army, and you're willing to wake up in the middle of the night to nurse your baby, or to burp your baby, or to change your baby, or to make your husband sandwiches, you know, when he wakes up 4 o'clock in the morning to go out to work, and, you know that he could depend on you, and know that you could depend on him. And the same thing with our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the same thing with Torah. It's the same mashal. My brother learned in Goshen Har Etzion for many years. And you all know the new building? It's not new anymore. It's like a space capsule. It's a modern building. And so when they first when they were building it, and it was about to be finished, so Rav Amitai, this is before Rav Lifton came to the yeshiva, he got the guys together and said, does anybody have any ideas what we should write on the Aron Kodesh? So one of the guys says, just take a look.
Answer it?
Just tell them that, to call back in half hour. As one of the guys suggested, to write on the parochet to the Aron Kodesh, Tov li Torat picha me'alfei zahav v'chesed. Ma ahavti Torah techa, another guy suggested. How much I love the Torah. The Torah is greater, it's sweeter than gold and silver. And Rav Amitai said, and what if it's boring? You're not going to learn Torah if it's boring? What, when you get to Sefer Vayikra and all those, you know, Korbanot, you're just going to skip over? Hey, let's just go over to Sefer Bamidbar, it's more interesting. You learn Torah, even if it's Leah, not just the Rachel, right? The details, not just the ideals. So one of the other guys suggested cynically, let's write on the parochet, Kafa aleim har kegigit. Right? That says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu held Mount Sinai over us and forced us to accept the Torah, whether we like it or not. So Rav Amitai answered, like gam v'gam. Because both are true. Right? The Torah is made up of details, and it's made up of ideals. And you can't have a forest without trees, and you can't have trees without forest. And you can't have the king without his clothes, and you can't have the clothes without the king. And this is Rachel, and this is Leah. And this is why Judaism has so many details, and why the rabbis succeeded where the Nevi'im, where the prophets did not succeed. Because they got us through the details of another Masechta, and another Masechta, and another Daf of Gemara, and another question regarding the laws of Lashon Hara, and another question regarding the laws of Tzniut. And are these shoelaces, are they Tzanua, or are they not Tzanua? Is this color, is it that? And all these questions which have been coming up, really, not for 3,300 years, but really in the last 2,000 years. Because this is where the rabbis, during the time of the Second Beit HaMikdash, shifted Judaism into a higher gear of a lot more details, and they succeeded in making us better people, more idealistic people, who bring the details of God into every aspect of life. Without that, we'll continue next time.